Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope and Bonaventure. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of Saint Bonaventure, the 13th century theologian and Franciscan, during his Wednesday general audience. Iraq's crossroads. We find out more about the views of Iraq's beleaguered Christian community as the nation prepares to vote in crucial parliamentary elections, whose outcome many fear could prompt a new spike in sectarian violence. And still going strong. We find out why an 80-year-old missionary priest who was kidnapped and held hostage for a month in the Philippines has returned to his work of helping kids there with special needs. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of Saint Bonaventure, the 13th century theologian and Franciscan, during his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
The Church should adopt a poor, obedient and chaste lifestyle. This was Pope Benedict XVI's reflection Wednesday during his general audience in the Paul VI Hall in front of 8,000 faithful.
Dear brothers and sisters, in our catechesis on the Christian culture of the Middle Ages, we now turn to Saint Bonaventure.
Pope Benedict dedicated his catechesis to Saint Bonaventure of Bagnoregio, revealing that the figure of this doctor of the Church evokes particular nostalgia for him because, as a young scholar, he studied the writings of the saint whose knowledge has greatly influenced his formation. Bonaventure was an early follower of St. Francis of Assisi, a distinguished theologian and teacher in the University of Paris. There, Bonaventure was called upon to defend the new mendicant orders, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, in the controversies which questioned the authenticity of their religious charism.
The friars here argued represent a true form of religious life, one which imitates Christ by practicing the evangelical counsels of poverty, chastity and obedience.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict XVI said, Bonaventure presents Francis as a man who passionately sought Christ. With the love that leads to imitation, he entirely conformed himself to him. Bonaventure indicated this as a living ideal for all the followers of St. Francis. Pope Benedict added, such an ideal, which remains valid for all Christians yesterday, today and always, was also suggested as the programme for the Church in the third millennium by John Paul II.
His writings still inspire us by their wisdom, penetrated by deep love of Christ and mystical yearning for the vision of God and the joy of our heavenly homeland.
At the end of the audience, as is tradition, the Holy Father then delivered greetings in various languages to the pilgrims present in the Paul VI Hall.
To the pilgrims from Sophia University in Tokyo, I offer my prayerful good wishes that the coming centenary of your university will strengthen your service to the pursuit of truth and your witness to the harmony of faith and reason.
Speaking to Polish pilgrims, Pope Benedict XVI recalled the fact that this year, as of March 1st, is the year of Frédéric Chopin, marking the bicentenary of the birth of this great Polish composer. And finally, turning to address participants in a meeting currently being held here at the Vatican on the subject of the pastoral care for gypsies, the Pope was treated to a rendition by the Rajko Gypsy Orchestra from Hungary. Thanking them for their performance, he expressed the hope that local churches across the world may work together to make an ever more effective commitment in support of the gypsy community. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Millions of Iraqis will be heading to the polls this weekend to vote in crucial parliamentary elections, whose outcome could put the country's future in balance between its rival sectarian groups. With more than 6,000 candidates competing, no one is expecting a straightforward outcome to the elections, which may mean weeks or months of political wrangling to form a ruling coalition. In 2005, a power vacuum following inconclusive elections triggered a massive increase in sectarian violence, and many fear this could happen again, threatening the country's shaky peace. Iraq's beleaguered Christian community is also worried that the outcome of these elections could herald a new wave of violence. At least 8 Christians have been killed in the last 2 weeks alone in the northern city of Mosul, and Pope Benedict has appealed to the Iraqi civil authorities to redouble their efforts to provide security to all Iraqis, and in particular to the most vulnerable religious minorities. A UN report published last week said over 4,000 Christians fled Mosul after the latest killings. Originally from Mosul, Dr. Suha Rassam is an Iraqi Catholic doctor now living in England, who has written a book about the history of Christianity in Iraq from its ancient beginnings. Along with a group of fellow Iraqi exiles, she has founded a charity to provide help for Iraqi Christians who have been forced to flee their homes as a result of the sectarian violence and chaos of the past few years, many of whom are now living in abject poverty. I began by asking her whether she fears a new spike in the violence if there's a power vacuum in Iraq after the elections.
They do fear, really, because the major forces that are active in Iraqi theater at the moment are still the Islamic religious parties of both sects, whether Shiites and Sunni. And although there are some secular parties and independent individuals who have presented themselves for the elections as secular people, and they would, they maintain that they would like to have separation between the state and religion. They would like to consider all Iraqi citizens as equal, irrespective of ethnicity and religion. They would like to incorporate some of the Ba'athis rather than complete sort of uprootal of any Ba'athist who cooperated with Saddam. These parties and these people, I think, would do better to incorporate all the elements that are positive for the country and would separate religion from the state and would be a hope for a new Iraqi society. But they are, unfortunately, a minority, and I doubt whether they would be able to get a majority seats in the coming elections.
Is it fair to say that Iraq is a country that's still extremely divided along sectarian and ethnic lines, and this election will show that very clearly?
It is still divided, and as I said, our hope is in the secular parties that would like to get rid of this sectarianism. There is also a hope that al-Maliki has moved a little bit away from sectarianism and has given his new list as the state of law rather than the Da'wah Islamic Party, as he used to call it. But he hasn't been successful for the last few years that he has been in power. So I'm not sure what will happen if a similar party come or if he himself also wins.
So how would you describe the mood among the Iraqis that you're still in touch with in your homeland, ahead of these elections?
Well, most of the people that I am in touch with, they are the Christians, and they are really afraid. They are not very happy. I tried to get in touch with 3 of them yesterday, and all of them have their telephone closed. They just are afraid. They don't want to talk to anybody for the time being.
Yes, turning to the Christians, as you well know, there's been a number of killings in the northern city of Mosul in recent weeks. So are the Christians there really living, as you imply, in a state of extreme fear? And do you think this is going to encourage more of them to leave?
Well, I don't know if the elections will be encouraging them to leave, but the present government haven't been able to contain the terrorists that are doing these killings. And there have been strong letters from religious leaders of all denominations accusing even the government of conspiracy because they were not able to address the problem. They said there's no excuse for what is happening. They are really making loud noises. There has been a demonstration in Baghdad asking the government to protect the Christians. So, yes, the church now is speaking very loudly. So whether the perpetrators are Al-Qaeda or whether, as was suggested at one stage, especially in the 2008 killings, that the Kurds may be involved, whoever is responsible, the government haven't been able to find them or to punish them. And this worries the whole Christian community, not only in Mosul, but in the whole country. So all the Christians are living in fear.
So when you talk to them, and I know that you originally came from Mosul, what do they say to you about life there, how they go about their daily life, what sort of security measures they have to take to protect themselves?
Well, you tell me I come from Mosul, yes, and I know the situation in Mosul. I lived in, I was born there, and I lived there until I went to college to Baghdad. So as a young adult, I was in Mosul, and we always were worried of some very extremist Muslims who are well known in Mosul. So, and the atrocities that has happened in 68 are well known. Even the atrocities of 1933, the massacre of the Assyrians, the Mosul responsible people could be implied in it. So Mosul is a ripe place for extremist Islamists. And it's believed that when the problem in Anbar was resolved, the extremist Al-Qaeda movement moved to Mosul and made alliance with just such extremist Muslims. So this is why the situation in Mosul now is in such a dire strait. And the last 2 years, people who have been there and come back, they say it is a no-go area for the Christians. They just have to go and do these certain things, minimum things, and come back to their homes. And now they are attacking them while they are in their own homes. There has been a family, 5 armed people, forced the door open, went in, killed the father and 2 sons, and raped the sister and the mother. This happened on the 24th of February. And for the last 2 months, the number killed is about 16 in 2 months in similar ways.
So do you actually know Christian families who have decided to leave the city and flee Iraq, or flee at least to other areas of Iraq because of the situation in Mosul?
Yes, I know several. The first atrocities that happened in 2008, which started in October, led to 15,000 people leaving the city of Mosul to the northern cities of Iraq. And since then, I have heard from Syria and Jordan that people have been coming to Syria and Jordan because the refugees have started to go abroad, and we thought that this is going to be finished. You know, America, certain European countries accepted lots of refugees, and refugees were decreasing in these countries. And in recent months, it has suddenly increased again, and this is related to the atrocities that has been happening in Mosul since 2008.
You said that you lived in Mosul until you went to college. I mean, what was life like then for the Christian community? You said there's always been a history of Islamic extremism. But I mean, in those days, did you go about your daily business without the fear of attacks?
Yes, in those days there was security. I mean, I hear some of my friends who go in very Muslim areas, who, you know, go to school through Muslim areas. I remember them telling me about them being hit, people coming and asking them to be Muslims, taking their bags and so on and so forth. So this was there, but the rule of law was very strong and there were no atrocities committed. There may have been some discriminations, but as soon as a law of order breaks, which happened in 68, then Christians were killed. And in those days, they were accused of being communists. So this was the mood. I lived in Mosul. I was secure. My family was secure. We went about our business and we had many Muslim friends at school. We had full rights. You know, I don't remember being treated in any different way than my Muslim friends. So everybody was beginning to sort of feel Iraqi and that all citizens are equal. But as I said, we still hear of people who, you know, are like Christian haters or like anti, who call us infidels and so on.
And how important is the role of the Chaldean Catholic Church in Mosul? I know that you are a Catholic.
Yes. As you know, their bishop was killed in Mosul, not only the bishop, but the Raghid Ghani, the priest. He was killed in 2007, and the bishop was killed in 2008. And they were adamant to sort of stay where they are and to pray in their churches and to defend their communities, and they were killed. Now we have a new bishop being consecrated for Mosul, and I heard that he would not be able to live in Mosul, but maybe in one of the nearby villages. Muslims. So they are trying their best. They are talking to some benevolent Muslim leaders. But what else can they do?
You, along with another group of Iraqi exiles, have founded a charity to help Christians who have been forced to leave their home and who are either internally displaced in other areas of Iraq or who have fled to neighboring countries in the wake of the chaos and violence of the last few years. What is their plight like?
The plight of the refugees is really bad. I visited Syria 2 years ago and met them. Other members of the charity visited in Jordan. And the situation there is that they are not recognized as refugees by the governments. They, you know, by, let us say, Syria, Jordan, or any other government in the Middle East where there are refugees. They consider them guests. In some places, they have to pay fines if their visas expire. So they really are in very difficult situations. They are depending mainly on their relatives who live abroad. Those who have relatives abroad are all right, but those who don't have relatives abroad are in abject poverty and depend on the charity of the churches, on the churches and charities like ours.
I was speaking to Suha Rassam, an Iraqi Catholic doctor and author, and a co-founder of the charity Iraqi Christians in Need. Father Mick Sinnell is a very resilient 80-year-old Irish priest who was kidnapped last year by Muslim militants on the island of Mindanao in the Philippines. He was held in captivity by the militants for a month before being released. Despite that traumatic experience and his own advanced age and frail health, Father Mick has returned to his mission at Pagadien in Mindanao, where he runs a centre to help care for children with special needs. He spoke to my colleague Ema McCarthy about his work with these children and his experience as a captive.
I worked in two parishes, in Dumalino and in San Miguel. And during all the times I worked in parishes, I came across these children with special needs and wished to do something for them, but never had the time with the pressure of parish work and the numbers that we had in the parishes. So when I was going home on vacation in 1998, I proposed to the society and to the bishop that maybe I could try and do something for them. So when I came back, I started a centre in 1998 for children with special needs.
When you say during your parish work you came across children who were suffering disabilities, physical, mental disabilities, and that you wanted to do something for them, were they to a certain extent abandoned by society at large? Were they marginalised? Was there no infrastructure there before to help them?
They were certainly marginalised. Very often they were hidden away in homes. Even the parents did not know how to help them best. When we started, we did a survey in the parish in which I was working, and we got 37 children with special needs, and we decided that was enough to start with. And we called a meeting for the parents to ask them what we could do for them. And of course, the first thing they wanted was a school. But gradually, they began to speak much longer about their child and about the problems. It took almost 2.5 hours, but when it was finished, you could almost feel a sense of relief in the room, because it was the first time they could speak about their problems to an audience that was sympathetic and understood. And the first time they got any hope that anything could be done for their children.
And now, almost 20 years after its founding, how many children do you care for currently?
11 years. Currently, we have about 60 children who come to the centre each day. We have a vehicle which collects them and delivers them after they are finished. Then there would be about 15 to 20, the number varies a bit, more who are confined to their homes by the severity of their disabilities, whom the staff would visit once a week for tutorials or therapy or both as needed. And they would teach their parents and the families how best to help the children.
Can you tell us any stories or tell us about any of the children who you've helped in these 11 years since the centre has been up and running that can give an example of how important this centre has been in improving the life, quality of life for these children and for their family?
Well, for those who were capable, we prepared them to get into mainstream education. And since we began, we have got 21 children into mainstream education. For the the rest will never benefit too much from academic education, but we give them as much as they're capable of, and then try to make them as independent as possible as regards their own personal needs, such as hygiene, washing, dressing, toileting, nearly all the basic things, also some simple cooking and housework. Now, I suppose our greatest success was, well, the one that stands out most in my mind, was a child of 5 years of age who came to us having no legs beneath both knees. She could hop around inside the room and hop onto a chair, but when she was going from room to room, she had to be carried. Now, we sent her after a year to Davao to get prosthesis, and after an operation to prepare her stumps for the prosthesis, she got the prosthesis and then did an exam for the public school and was admitted to grade two. She's now in second year high school. But she would never have had that chance unless she got prosthesis, because she wouldn't be accepted in any public school when she came to us.
Absolutely fantastic. But this is the work of the school is completely reliant on donations and donations and the goodwill of other people. So how difficult is it for you to keep the school running?
Well, it is extraordinary. God has been very good to us, actually, since the beginning, and money has come from the most unexpected of places. Also now, because I'm celebrating my 80th birthday in December, I haven't too many more years to go, so I was able to establish a trust fund, the interest of which would help to run the program when I am gone. And the interest on that now can almost run the program.
Now, perhaps not all of our listeners are aware, but last year you were kidnapped by an armed gang from the compound of the school itself, or was it from your own home?
No, from our own home here. There's a short driveway going in front of the house going down to the street, and I was walking up and there, as has been my custom for the last 2 years, getting exercise for my heart. I do about 40 minutes each night, and I was kidnapped from there by a group who called themselves the Lost Command. I was kidnapped on October the 11th and released on November the 12th.
Without going into too much detail of an experience which I'm sure you'd rather forget than remember, would you like to tell our listeners about that experience and with the kidnappers themselves and then how you managed to keep positive throughout the whole experience? Because one thing that struck me from the reports of your comments when on your release was that you were, of course, happy to be released, but you were very upset about the whole experience, and that struck me as being quite strange.
Well, I wouldn't say I was upbeat. Due to all that, I was amazed when I came out to hear about the coverage that the kidnapping had got and the number of people who were praying for me, not only here and in Ireland, but in many other places as well. And the prayers were certainly effective, because I never had any ill effects at all from the experience. I had neither pain nor ache, cough or cold during the 32 days I was away. The first 10 days were in the swamps, and things were quite difficult there. We lived in the open all the 32 days I was away, with a sort of a tarpaulin over us to protect us from the rain. And the living conditions, I suppose, were very, very primitive. But you can get used to everything, and after a while I got used to it. I was quite a bit annoyed in the beginning with the Lord, because I had found it difficult to pray, even though I had all day to pray, and I tried. But I had no feeling of devotion or the sense that the Lord was close to me. But after a day or two, I got that certain calm that I could leave things safely in His hands, and that He would take care of me no matter what happened, whatever was going to happen. And looking back, I would say that He was certainly there all the time, yes, although I didn't realize it at the time. After the actual kidnapping itself, which was very rough, and when I got into the boat, it took me by boat first before we started hiking for about 3 hours, but they could not have been more helpful in trying to make things as easy as possible for me in the difficult situation in which we were living. So that was also a big help. And they told me when I got into the boat that I need not worry, that they would not think of killing a priest. And I never had any great fear that I was confident that the people who were guarding me would not do me any harm. There was the danger, perhaps, if the military tried to rescue me by force, that I would be killed in the fighting between the two groups.
But it all came to a good end, thank God. One thing that also struck me is when we were covering the story of your kidnapping and during the period that you were abducted and no one knew where you were and the search was ongoing. One thing that really rang through very loudly and very clearly was, first of all, the love the children of your centre had for you, because so many of them made appeals. That struck a chord an awful lot with the international community. And the second thing was how much your work and your person and your mission had affected not only the Catholics in Pagadian, but right across other religious communities. Everyone knew who you were and everyone did everything they possibly could to try and publicise your story and to pray for your release, not only Catholics. Did this also surprise you?
Well, I attend once a month here. We have a forum for a Muslim Christian forum for solidarity and peace, and I knew the Muslims would also be praying for me. As a matter of fact, there's great devotion here to the Divine Mercy at 3 o'clock. So the Catholics said they would pray for me at 3 o'clock, and the Muslims said they would pray for me at the 5 o'clock prayer. But as I said before, I was amazed really in how the thing had the imagination or something of the people. I can't really explain that. And the number of people that were praying for me and who followed it, who followed the kidnapping and the search for my release.
But as I said before, thank God it all came to a very happy end. It seemed to have been purely for ransom reasons. Is that right?
That is correct. It's made that clear to me that it was purely for ransom. The people who were guarding me said that they were very angry with the MILF, who said that kidnapping a priest was against the Quran, because they said that was all right for them to say that because they had money coming from outside. But that we have no money coming from outside. The only way we can get money to buy arms and ammunition is by kidnapping.
Moving perhaps a little bit away from the kidnapping, but not completely. When you were released, obviously your health was frail, even though you'd done amazingly well for someone who has a serious heart condition to survive all those days in abduction and on the move in harsh conditions. You returned to Ireland, as you said, courtesy of the Irish government, to spend a time with relatives and to regain your strength. And then, of course, the news comes across the wires that Father Mick is back in Pagadian. Most people would have thought, is he completely and utterly insane? And perhaps don't understand this choice. Can you try and explain it for us?
Well, this has been my work all my life, and I figure I can still work for a few years that are left of me, for as long as I can. I would like to do the little I can for as long as I can. And really, I had no way I could work anyplace else, and I don't feel there's any danger now that it will happen a second time.
So, to conclude the interview, Father Mick, can I ask you a question? What is priestly mission, or what is a missionary priest? What does mission mean for you?
Really, well, I suppose in the beginning or the early days when we came here, we were coming out to save souls. But really, it's to bring the good news, I suppose, to the people. People who have no chance of practicing when we came here because there were so few priests. Even now, the average parish here for one man would probably be 14,000 people scattered over a fairly wide area. And some people would say the Philippines is not really mission because the people are Catholic. But I suppose the really thing is to be an instrument in the hands of God and bringing the grace of God to different people. And now, like any priest, I suppose, I have to admit that God has used me to touch the lives of many people. Sometimes he picks the most peculiar of instruments to achieve this.
That was Irish Columban priest Father Mick Sinnoh speaking to Emma McCarthy. That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.